I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. President Trump's executive order to suspend entry to refugees and citizens from seven predominantly Muslim countries has met with controversy. Some claim the move makes the nation safer. Others say it's unconstitutional and unethical. Today we'll hear from voices on both sides of the issue and find out what the order means for immigrants already here. But first, we catch up with Chef Lydia Bastianich. It's been 5 years since she was on the show. We'll find out what she's been up to and how she's bringing the taste of Venice to Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Lydia Bastianich is one of the cornerstones of the Create channel on PBS. Starting in 1998, her series on Italian cooking continues to emphasize a seasonal, simple, and nutritionally sound approach to cooking. Hers is a story that never fails to inspire. An immigrant to America at age 12, she began working part-time in a bakery at 14, then after high school, full-time at a pizzeria. By age 24, she and her husband had opened a little restaurant in Queens. Fast forward to today, and Lydia Bastianich oversees a food empire. Besides her TV show, there are restaurants in multiple cities, the Food Emporium Eataly in four locations, cookware selling on QVC, Lydia's Food Products, a television production company, and, oh yeah, a couple of vineyards over in Italy. If we thought Lydia was doing well when we first interviewed her in 2011, then she's going gangbusters now. She'll be in town on Thursday for a big night at her restaurant here, but for now she joins us from NPR Studios in New York. And Lydia Bastianich, so good to have you back here on Up to Date.
Ah, thank you, Steve. My pleasure.
You're not going to remember this, but the last time you were on the show, we were at your restaurant here, and you sort of got on me a little bit for not using a whisk correctly, and I just wanted you to know I've worked past the pain, and I'm a whole lot better at it now.
Oh, good. So you can whisk those eggs? I know that was the problem.
Oh, it was a problem. According to you, anyway, it was a big problem.
All right. As long as you get over it.
Well, you've always been proud of the American immigrant story, your own and others. You've explored it in several PBS specials, using food to highlight the contributions of those who have come to this country. Can I ask where your thoughts turned when you heard of President Trump's executive order on immigration?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it kind of choked me in a sense, you know, and since I came here at age of 12 and, you know, I came from a part of Italy that became communist. It was given to communist Yugoslavia. And we were deprived of our freedom. I mean, we couldn't speak Italian. We couldn't go to church. So when finally I came here at 12, we got freedom. This country was you know, everything that I hoped for and more, the opportunity, the freedom. And so when I hear these kind of things, I am concerned about losing my freedom, let me tell you, you know, because I was there. But at the same time, you know, it's all about these immigrants, people like me. You know, my children now are born here, but America is based on immigrants. And if you give immigrants a chance, they're so appreciative, you know, of this new opportunity.
You know, family is so important to you, Lydia. So let's get an update on yours. I particularly want to ask you about your mother, Erminia, who is just a kick when she's in the kitchen with you. How's she doing these days?
She just turned 96, and
wow.
She's as feisty as ever. You know, she has a little stick, a walking stick, but otherwise her mind is as sharp as a tack. She does her crossword puzzles every day.
That's the key.
I think so. And she assists me. She's my sous chef. You know, she doesn't stand up around the stove anymore, but at the table, I give her the onions, the garlic, whatever, the vegetables. And she cleans them for me, and you know, she lives with me, so it's still, I am very blessed to have her for all these years.
Lydia Bastianich is my guest. Your son Joe came into the family business back in 93 when he asked you and his father to partner with him in a New York restaurant. He's made frequent appearances on your PBS show as a sommelier and then came Italy. Explain how that came about.
Well, you know, you were talking about sort of giving my bio a little bit in the success story. And I must say, Steve, that, you know, a success is not a solitary journey. And, you know, my husband and I worked very hard and we did plant the seeds. And we had, by the time the kids came in, we had our third restaurant. But this expansion is a lot due to the kids coming in. And of course, all the great people that came on board as a team with us. And my son, who, you know, when my kids were small, they grew up in a real restaurant in a sense. You know, they came, they did their homework there, they ate dinner, and then they went home with grandma while mom and dad continued to work the evening. And as they grew, as they became teenagers, I would always tell them, you know, this is not what you want to do when you grow up. You're in America, you're an American, you need to go to school, you need to get a great education, and you need to get an American job. Now, I didn't know what an American job, but I didn't want them to sort of, you know, get into the restaurant business. And I must say, you know, I'm very proud of them. Joe got his master's in business, Tanya had a PhD in Renaissance art. Now they both work with the business. And they're the one that sort of brought all these other elements, the winery, Joe's passion, the books. Tanya co-authored 5 books with me. She works on the production of my show. So it's this kind of family support and expansion that really has brought me where I am.
So is it did the kids bring you the empire that is yours today?
Yes, I mean it's ours. It's not,
sure,
you know, it's not,
sure,
it's not mine. It's ours. And along the way, we took in a lot of partners. So, you know, we started with the little restaurant. My son came in, as you said, and then he partnered with Mario Battali, and that grew in its own. You know, with their babbo and we have now Del Posto together. Then my daughter came back from Italy to have her children. You know, she wanted to be close to home, and she, while she was home raising her children, began helping me with my books, doing the research and co-authoring with me. Then she got into my production. The production side grew. And this is how it grows. But then also along the way, you know, Italy, it's another partner relationship. Oscar Farinetti, when he opened his first door, I went to see it because I'm curious. I wanted to see. And we became friends. And he says, you know, Lydia, I really think that this concept would work in New York. And I asked, you know, my family and Mario and all of that, do we want to do this? And we did. And so that's another success story. So, you know, Steve, it's kind of taking the opportunities with the right people, right kind of idea in mind. And let me tell you, work very hard.
You know, there are great advantages to working with family. And sometimes there can be downsides, too. How have you guys navigated that?
Oh, let me tell you, there's great advantages, but there are disadvantages. I think, you know, it's just understanding of being a family. And I think, you know, that's where I do play a role, sort of the matriarch in a sense. My important kind of dividing line was, where do I stop being a nagging parent and where, you know, and where do I transcend into a partner?
That's tricky, too. That's tricky.
It is. It is. Because, you know, if you're a partner, equal time, you know, and you can't help it. This is my little kid here, you know, but you have to separate and you have to. I think one thing that's important, Steve, in family businesses is give the next generation the opportunity to grow their ideas.
Right. Right.
And you know, they have to grow on their own. They cannot be in my shadow, you know, and that has happened, you know, very well. Joe took off on his own. He has television. We're always in the business together, but he has his own presence. My daughter on her own now, you know, with the book, she's working with children's books. She's working with a possible animation series and so on down the line.
You know, we're talking with Chef Lydia Bastianich. She'll be in town on Thursday for a carnival celebration at Lydia's Kansas City. From 5 to 9, diners will enjoy a 4-course Venetian meal created by executive chef Dan Swinney. And, of course, Chef Lydia herself will be on hand to greet and talk with guests. I wanted to ask you about a couple of things on the menu for the Venetian meal that I'm not sure I'd be willing to try, so you're going to have to sell me on these, Lydia.
Okay.
An appetizer with Venetian-style chicken liver and onions.
Oh, well, that's delicious. And it's
easy for you to say.
Well, but you have to taste it. You know, I mean, you have to kind of get into the flavor of things.
It's liver, Lydia. I'm just reminding you.
But it's good, not too much, you know, but it becomes sweet when you kind of cook it with the onions and you smother it. It becomes kind of sweet, you know, and it's very nutritious. Not too much of it, a little bit of everything. But, you know, the whole Venetian cuisine, you know that Italy has 20 regions and Veneto, with the capital of Venice, is one of the regions. But from the about 600s to the 1200s, Venice was a city-state, and it was a very important city-state in Italy, or in Europe, if you will. And what made it important and rich was the spice trades. You know, Venetians on the Adriatic, sailors, great sailors, would go, of course, and to the Orient, to the East, and bring back spices like cinnamon, clove, coffee, pepper. And those things, you know, because those spices are in the tropical belt. So we Europe didn't have them, the Northern Europe. We are in the temperate zone, so we had a lot of fresh herbs. But those spices were so appreciated, and it really made the Venetian Empire a rich city-state. And still today, there was this Carnevale there that is celebrated very, very much. And, you know, Carnevale is the day before Lent begins. Ah. So Carnevale is kind of the day, because Lent is kind of rigorous. You watch what you eat, how you behave piously, and so on. But the night before, you get dressed in a mask, in a costume, and you're allowed to play pranks, to eat, to drink, to do all of those things that then you will have to kind of stay away from. So that's why Carnevale is very, very kind of look forward to. And even today in Venice, the Carnevale of Venice is a beautiful, the whole city is in a kind of festivity mode. So, but the food, the local foods is what makes it as well.
So it's Carnevale. Am I saying that?
Carnevale.
Right? Carnevale.
Carnevale.
Okay. Uh-huh. Then on the menu.
Carne means meat.
Sure.
Vale
sure.
means valid. Oh. So Carnevale, that's when you eat all the meat you can, because Lent, you don't supposedly at those times, you didn't eat any meat.
There you go.
So let me tell you a little kind of. A Carnevale, ogni scherzo vale. It means on Carnival, every prank is permitted. That's the saying.
Sounds great. Also on the menu is risotto with cuttlefish. Cuttlefish?
Yes.
What is that?
Oh, my goodness. Cuttlefish.
Don't start with me, Lydia. Yeah.
Cuttlefish. I mean, you know, once I'm out there, we're going to get together again. We're going to really get your hands on cuttlefish now.
I'd like to.
Now, cuttlefish is in the family of calamari, or, you know, that it's just
squid.
A different.
Yeah.
It's a squid. It's in a family of the squids, but it's just a little different. It's meatier, and it's black ink is sought after to make risotto nero. When you make the black risotto, you use the cuttlefish ink. And it's delicious and sweet. And, you know, the meat, you can make a prosciutto, you can fry it, you can do, you know, a lot of things with the fish.
Then there's lobster tail in brodetto.
Okay, brodetto is a technique. Brodo means soup. That means cooking kind of fish in a soupy manner. Mm. Now, again, you know, Venetians, a lot of sailors, when they would go off to sea, they would make this soup stew, and they would put a little bit of vinegar, the acidity, because acidity kind of preserves the food for a few extra days. So in the Venetian cuisine, there's a lot of use of vinegar. And brodetto, one preparation of fish, it has a little bit of vinegar. It's delicious. Mm. And you know, with a little bit of polenta because, you know, that area up there, we now, Venice, in Venice, they like their polenta white.
Okay, then for dessert, Lydia, I might try the torta sabbiosa. Sabbiosa.
Sabbiosa.
Sabbiosa.
Sabbia means sand.
Sand. Okay. Why am I interested in eating sand?
Well, because it's delicious in this case. It's where the cake is really simple, but it crumbles, but moist crumbles. So are you getting into it now?
You sort of sold me on each of these things. I
Oh,
went in,
good.
I was a little skeptical of the liver and the cuttlefish, but I think I'm there with you now.
But let me tell you, if all else fails, the beef short ribs in Venetian spices, that's the whole story of the Venetian spices that I told you about. But this beef has in it cloves, and it has the cinnamon, and it has the black pepper, and it has even a little bit of chocolate in there.
Chocolate.
So
Yeah.
it's a great short rib.
I'm not sure how often you get to be the guest at a dinner, but you were front and center at the Boys Grow fundraiser here in town last September. What made you want to help out this program that cultivates skills in young men while they cultivate the land? What was that all about?
It goes back, Steve, to maybe my growing up, and really, again, going back to that communist Yugoslavia period, where I did a lot of living with grandma, and she raised and all the animals and the food that we ate, and I was kind of a little helper, runner around, and I was very much involved in the land. I mean, I would, of course, collect the tomatoes, the beans. We would dry the beans for the winter. I would go and help up. Dig out the potatoes, from the earth, from the still warm potatoes. So I really connect, and I think that my passion for food, and to a certain extent, my appreciation for land, food, respecting it, goes back to me being really on firsthand with grandma on the land. And when John at Boys Grow came up the first year that he sort of proposed the idea, I just loved it from the get-go. First of all, this is for inner city teenager boys, which is a tender age, an age that needs guidance. So an education, of course, is, I think that education is the solution. Education and food diplomacy, I think, is the solution to our world problems here.
What does working with the land do for those young men?
But it gives them a sense. You plant something, you plant a seed, you take the time, the work to plant the seed, and it yields a product to you. It yields reward. It gives you food. Then they go on from there. They harvest it. Then they go on from there. They produce, they get ideas, they make things out of sauces or jams. Then they develop, the packaging for it, so, and then they go and market it. So they have, from the land, the appreciation of the land and really respect for it to a business model in a sense for a young man. And I think it's just one, and they love it. These young teenagers, when you talk to them, just beam. They just beam because they are successful at something. The land gives them back when they put that seed on, and then they take it on to another level and make a product out of it. That gives them confidence. That makes them kind of feel like a success. And those basic principles they can apply on into their life as they develop their career.
Well, the Carnevale of Venice takes place this Thursday at Lydia's Kansas City, and the great lady herself will be right there with you. Dinner's from 5 to 9, seating's limited, so you might call ahead for a reservation. And Lydia Bastianich, it's always a pleasure to have you here. You're just such a joy, and I always enjoy having you.
Thank you, Steve. A presto.
Yes, same to you, and we'll see you soon, okay? Lydia Bastianich. Okay, time for a break. When we come back, Congressman Kevin Yoder hopefully will be here, and we'll talk immigration, Donald Trump's controversial immigration orders, with a couple of guests. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church is looking for solutions to Kansas City's culture of violence. On yesterday's program, we learned how they're conducting that search. Go to kcur.org/up-to-date for that. Tomorrow, the latest Conversation at the Square features Mayor Sly James and two school superintendents discussing those things outside of the classroom that can affect a school's ability to set students up for success. That's tomorrow on KCUR. Up to date. Congressman Kevin Yoder can't make it. He's on the floor of the House right now. But meantime, most of the country is aware by now that President Trump took controversial action with regards to immigration in the past few days. For those who don't, the president's order suspended entry of all refugees to the U.S. for 120 days. It barred Syrian refugees indefinitely and blocked entry into this country for 90 days for citizens of seven predominantly Muslim countries. His supporters praise it as a move that will keep the nation safer. Critics call it unconstitutional and unethical. Now, a conversation with folks on both sides of this issue. First, Ira Melman. He's media director for FAIR. That's the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group that has long supported dramatic cuts to the number of immigrants into this country. Ira Melman, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thanks very much.
How does this order make this country safer, Ira?
Well, you know, President Obama's own top national security officials testified before Congress on a number of occasions saying that we don't have the capacity to screen people who are coming from countries like Syria. You have to remember, if you're going to do vetting, there has to be some kind of database against which to match up information. Those simply don't exist in places like Syria. So the vetting process is much more complicated than it has been, throughout our history of taking refugees into the United States. We also have to recognize that ISIS has told us that they've made it very clear that they intend to infiltrate operatives along with the refugee flow. So, you know, we do have to take proper precautions, whether it is what President Trump is doing or other matters, other ways of going about doing the vetting. We should not be admitting people and then trying to figure out, you know, are these people here because they're fleeing oppression in their homeland, or are they here because they intend to carry their jihad to the United States?
Ira, CNN just reported this. They said no person accepted to the U.S. as a refugee, Syrian or otherwise, has been implicated in a major fatal terrorist attack since the Refugee Act of 1980 set up systematic procedures for accepting refugees into the U.S. This is according to an analysis of terrorism immigration risks by the libertarian-leaning Cato Institute. If refugees pose no terrorist threat to American citizens, what's the point of an order like this?
Well, just because it hasn't happened yet, it doesn't mean that the danger doesn't exist. You know, if we were talking on September 10th, 2001, and we were discussing whether people overstaying their student visas posed a danger to the United States, well, there would be no evidence to that fact. But 24 hours later, we found out very different. Look, we have seen in Europe, there have been a number of attacks, including the Paris attack in November of 2015, in which people who had entered Europe under the guise of being refugees were participating in these attacks. So we don't need to wait until something goes boom and then try to figure it all out. If ISIS is telling us that they intend to do this, if it has happened in Europe, just because it hasn't happened here yet doesn't mean we shouldn't take it seriously. And by the way, in 2011, President Obama suspended the admission of Iraqi refugees for 6 months based on the same concerns.
You know, the Trump administration wants to initiate something called extreme vetting of applicants. What would you like to see added to the current process, a process that can already take 18 to 24 months now to complete?
Well, first of all, you know, we need to have our own people doing these kinds of investigations. And, you know, the part of the problem is that the volume has been so enormous, and not just refugees, but the intake of immigrants, that we tend to miss a lot of very important things. The attack in San Bernardino in December of 2015, carried out by Tafshin Malik, she was admitted to the United States. She was vetted by our embassy personnel in Pakistan, her native country. They miss countless red flags because they are so overwhelmed they can't do the due diligence assistance that is necessary. So we need to look at our entire policy, the volume of people that we are admitting, and determine whether we are admitting people faster than we can do effective background checks. So these are the sorts of things that need to be looked at. We want to be able to protect refugees. Certainly there are people coming from countries like Syria who deserve to be protected. But we also have to balance that with concern about what impact it's going to have in the United States and whether we are going to expose our own people to danger, just as, you know, we've seen happen in Europe.
Ira, I got 30 seconds left. If you're a potential terrorist, why not just wait it out? Wait the 120 days or the 90 days and then, you know, do what you do.
Well, some of them might, but, you know, what the purpose of this is to get better vetting procedures in place so that we can identify the people who pose us a threat before they get to the United States. So that's really the objective of this. We'll see if the administration is able to accomplish that.
That's Ira Melman. He's media director for FAIR. That's the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Ira, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, now the on-again, off-again Congressman Kevin Yoder, he's back on again. He joins us now from Washington. He represents the state's 3rd district that includes Johnson and Wyandotte counties. And, Congressman, it's always good to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show. I apologize. I was actually on the floor talking about this very issue, giving a speech. So I have a chance to be on your show and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and all your listeners.
Thanks, Kevin. And I appreciate, I'm wondering how much feedback you're getting right now from your constituents back home in the wake of President Trump's executive order. How hot of an issue is this?
Well, we've had a lot of feedback on a number of issues, which, you know, certainly I'm grateful for because it gives us an opportunity to hear what's on people's minds. And so we encourage that, throughout my service in the last number of years to the community. We've had concerns from both the right and the left and the center, and everyone's has concerns from time to time. So we are seeing a lot. Certainly people are worried about the standard this is setting. I think I share a number of the concerns. I'm particularly concerned about people who are lawful entrants, people who have visas, who are already planning to come to the United States, and who are detained at the border. I think that was wrong. And, you know, over the years, we've helped a number of families who have left the country maybe on a work visa and not been able to get back in because the consulate has stopped them for a reason. So we stand ready to help any families that are wrongfully detained. And then going forward, Steve, you know, we have to have a country that is both safe and compassionate. And I think the folks on either side of this debate, none of their principles are in the wrong place. I think it's just finding where that balance is. We've got a long history of having a refugee program that has let tens of thousands in this country every year, and the president's order, I think, allows 50,000 in, which is consistent with Barack Obama's numbers. And so what we've got to do is ensure that we can represent to the American people that the vetting process works, that it is secure as it can be, because I think that's key to having a good refugee program going forward, and hopefully we can come together as a country on this and really find balance between those twin dilemmas we always have, compassion versus security.
So bottom line it for us, Congressman, is the president doing the right thing here?
Well, I think in part the idea of going through this vetting process is something a number of us have wanted to do for a long time. You know, Barack Obama did this with Iraq, put a 6-month stay on refugees coming in from Iraq and also refugees from Syria at a point. I think you didn't see this outrage. So I think some of this is misplaced because the outrage didn't occur with President Obama. So I think there's some consistency here. But I think the way this is being implemented is hurting people that it didn't need to hurt. And I wish the president would have worked with Congress just like we wish President Obama would have. And these executive orders and this overrunning the voice of the elected representatives is what created a lot of this mess. And I think if they would have gone through a step-by-step process, you might have even seen Democrats joining in saying they want a strengthening of the vetting process as well. I don't see a lot of people saying we don't want to strengthen the vetting process. I think their concern is how this is actually implemented.
The conservative Cato Institute, I just mentioned to a previous guest, just came out, Congressman, with a study that showed that refugees pose no threat. What about that? And doesn't that render all this kind of moot?
Well, I don't know that you could say that refugees as a whole pose no threat because we haven't been able to demonstrate that. We know that some of the attacks...
Well, the stats demonstrate it, though, Congressman. But Cato went back and looked at all these refugees, and there's been no issue.
Well, does that mean it won't be an issue going forward? I think the point is, Steve, and I think you would have to agree with this, that when you're allowing people to come in the country, that particularly if they're coming from ISIS-related regions, and we know that they have said they would like to use the refugee process, that we would be foolish to act like this isn't a way to bring people into this country. And this is one of those better be safe than sorry. We hopefully never have an issue with someone who's come in under the guise of a refugee and attacked our country. We don't want that to, of course, happen. And so this is a better safe than sorry issue. I don't know, Steve, where the outrage was when President Obama paused this for 6 months. Did he somehow say that there was a refugee issue then? So I guess the point is that a lot of this conflict is being created in the implementation. This was a very bipartisan issue. I mean, we passed a bill last year that set the structure up to be able to do this, and many Democrats voted for it.
And just to point out that President Obama, what he did, Congressman, was limited just to one country, right, and was a response to a very specific threat.
Right. So this is seven countries, and so some have said that is overly broad, and I obviously don't have access to the information that would, at this moment, that would allow us to know whether it should be one country, should be Iraq like the president had, or whether it should just be Syria, or whether it should be, you know, Iran as well. But I think the point that the principle still applies, which was the president put a pause because he had concerns about security from refugees coming in. This is President Obama. So President Trump did it in a much broader way, and in a way that, you know, wasn't in conjunction with what Congress had sort of laid out. But
and that's the issue, though, right?
Right. That is the issue. That's my issue. I'm demanding that the White House do that as well, is to fix that as well. So to your question of is the, you know, are they in the right direction? I think consistent with what previous presidents have done, this new president had a commitment to national security, immigration security in particular. So that is consistent with what he campaigned on. It is consistent with what other presidents have done, maybe not at the same scale. But the implementation has been the problem here. And we are ready to help people, in our office has in the past. We did it when President Obama had orders. We will help lawful citizens of this country gain access if they're wrongfully detained.
That's Kansas Congressman Kevin Yoder from the state's 3rd District. Congressman, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks for having me on the
you
show.
You bet. Now for a different view on President Trump's immigration orders, I want to bring in Hillary Cohen Singer. She's Executive Director of Jewish Vocational Services, which helps immigrants to the U.S. adjust to their new lives. And Hillary, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You declined to be on air with Mr. Melman, again, the guest we had previously from FAIR. That's the group that we had on earlier today. Why did you decline to be on air with him?
I'm here as a representative of resettlement agencies, and our role is really to implement the program that our federal government puts in place to help refugees. And so that's really what I can speak to, is the impact on the ground, how it affects members of our own community.
So debating policy was not something
it
you wanted to
is
do.
It's not my area of expertise.
You just heard him lay out a case, and Congressman Yoder as well, that these orders make this country safer. Why doesn't that by itself justify what the president just has done here?
I think you have to look at the broader context of the track record of the refugee resettlement program. There is already a process in place that, to many people, does meet the test of extreme vetting. It is not an easy thing to enter this country as a refugee. There are extensive background checks.
People don't realize that oftentimes.
Yeah, it is a multi-year process that involves biometric screening, interviews, multiple departments of our federal government getting involved.
So you think the screening process already in place is rigorous enough? Am I hearing you correctly?
I think that the screening is quite rigorous. And over the years, there have been adjustments to the screening process when new technology has been introduced, when new specific threats have come to light that have not called for a total cessation of the program.
Your organization helped resettle nearly 600 refugees last year in the Kansas City area alone. You served hundreds more with employment and health services. What would have happened if this executive order had been in place even a year ago?
So no one that we serve would have been able to come to the United States. These are individuals who, by and large, have been in refugee camps for an average of 15 years.
15 years.
15
years. Overseas in refugee camps, you're talking about.
Correct. it is only less than 1% of the world's refugees that ever have that opportunity.
To come here.
To come here. So individuals who have been languishing in refugee camps really without any hope for a good life for themselves or their children, a lot of times suffering from medical complications, would not have had the opportunity to come here, to live, to work, to send their kids to school, to access health care, and create a life for themselves.
If the number is so low, what determines in other countries which refugees come to the U.S. and which ones don't?
There is an extensive vetting process. The first hurdle that people need to overcome is to prove that they have a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race, religion, or political beliefs. They have to have fled their country and be in fear for their lives they return.
But so many refugees in these other countries fall into that category. So who decides which ones come here and which ones don't?
It is the most vulnerable and the most vetted that end up making it to the United States.
Tell us about some of the refugees that are coming here. I mean, they're coming from where and what are they fleeing?
So we have refugees that are from 14 different countries. Many of them are fleeing conflicts that have long since subsided, but they have been unable to make their way back to their home country for fear of safety. So we work with individuals from the Democratic Republic of Congo, from Burma, from Bhutan. We also serve a large population of people who come to the United States under what's called a special immigrant visa. And these are individuals who have served our troops, who have their lives threatened because of that association, and are then finding refuge in the United States.
You know, I'm wondering, Hillary, if President Trump was sitting here at this table with us, what would you tell him about these people and what he's done with this order? What would be your message to him?
I think that America has long been a beacon of hope and freedom for some of the world's most vulnerable populations, that is fundamental to who we are as a country, and that this order takes that a giant step backwards.
And we should fear what from these people?
You know, they are like you and me. They want a better life. They have been without hope, without a future, and they're coming here to seek that.
Well, that's Hillary Cohen Singer. She's Executive Director of Jewish Vocational Services. Thank you very much for providing your perspective. I sure appreciate it. And now it's time for State House Blend. This week, we're on the Missouri side of the state line. Host Brian Ellison spoke with Representative Kevin Corlew, a Republican from Kansas City, about right to work, real ID, and expert witnesses.
Kevin, welcome to State House Blend.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here again. I always enjoy your show, and it's great to be a guest on it.
Great to have you back, and glad you could enjoy our trademark donuts as well.
They're very wonderful and a good snack to have.
Sadly, though, our other guest is joining us by phone, and so does not have access to the donuts. That's Jason Hancock, who covers the State House for the Kansas City Star. Jason, welcome to you nonetheless.
I appreciate it, and donuts in spirit, I suppose.
Yes, by all means, partake of whatever donuts you have there in solidarity. Kevin, is it just me, or have you had a pretty busy week in Jefferson City?
It's been a busy week, Brian. It's been a busy couple weeks to the start of the legislature. We've gotten through a number of bills that are moving through committee, and that's where I've been busy with some of the bills that I'm carrying this year in terms of Real ID, an expert witness bill, a student journalist bill, some other things that I'm happy to talk about.
Well, we will definitely talk about them, but I want to talk first about one that you are most certainly not carrying, which is right to work. It seems headed for passage, coming to you in the House maybe as early as this coming week. You've opposed this bill all along. In fact, that was sort of a costly decision on a certain level. A few Republicans who did oppose it last session got primary challenges. Some of them lost, funded by Joplin businessman David Humphreys. Of course, Humphreys was also a big supporter of Governor Greitens. Have you had any lasting sort of ramifications for your opposition to right to work?
Well, I did have a primary election this year and had a tough general as well, because I'm in a district that is a swing district. But it's a district that's more concerned about the issues that are important to them rather than whether you're a Republican or Democrat. And that's why I ultimately voted against Right to Work. But in the long run, the voters voted me back. And I feel that my decision was justified and proven by the vote that was gone, that went in my favor in November.
You haven't changed your mind about Right to Work?
No, I have not.
Before we get away from Right to Work, Kevin Corlew, I mean, this, as you said, this is a big issue. Those of you who oppose it, which is almost the entire Democratic caucus and then a few Republicans, is this the end of the conversation about Right to Work? Once this decision is made, are you eager to just move on and get on to other things, or do you plan to continue to pursue this? Are there steps that you can take to ameliorate what you see as any damage that might be done by this bill?
Well, on the particular issue of the right to work, I think once it's passed, that we need to move on to other things. But at the same time, we also need to be cognizant that we have good working conditions here in the state for our workers, that we're seeing good wages. There are issues in this particular bill that I'm concerned about in terms of opening up our businesses to unnecessary lawsuits and criminal implications and charges. So those are the kind of things that when it's implemented, we need to watch and be careful. And if there are remedies that need to be made, we need to address those.
You mentioned lawsuits. Let's move on to talk about some of the issues that affect the judicial system and the courts. You are very involved with a couple of those conversations. One that has received a lot of attention from the governor's State of the State address and other places is tort reform. Another is a bill that talks about expert witness testimony, and you're the sponsor of that bill.
Yes.
Let's start there. And for those who don't really understand the technicalities of this issue, give us the simple version. Give us the fifth grade version of this expert witness testimony bill. What are you trying to do?
Well, in court, when you're in particularly a complex case, a case that demands scientific evidence, and it's evidence that just isn't common knowledge to the average lay juror or lay person, then you rely upon experts to come in and testify about the science and the procedures, and then to give an opinion in the case. And there is a standard that has been used in the federal courts, including the federal courts here in Missouri, as well as two-thirds of the states, that sets a standard to say that that first of all, the person testifying really is an expert in terms of their knowledge, experience, education, training, or skill, and that two, the things that they're talking about, the opinion that they're bringing is based upon good scientific methods and procedures and sufficient facts and data. So it's just a means whereby that those experts that come and testify in court really are experts and are bringing forth good science.
So it would be up to a judge to rule that the expert meets those qualifications and that the things they're saying are rooted in that.
That's right. It's called a gatekeeping responsibility, and the judge does not make a determination whether he or she likes the opinion or whether that opinion, what the opinion is about. Rather, it's how they got to their opinion. So you can have competing theories, competing scientific theories that both go to the jury, and then the jury can decide.
Jason Hancock, what else is on your mind as we talk with Representative Kevin Corlew?
Well, I don't think we could let this whole thing go by without delving into the details of Real ID, obviously, especially since we're all going to be turned away at the airport, apparently, in January, unless the Missouri legislature does something. I was taken this week by the opposition from some members of the Republican Party in the House. There's obviously with some in the Senate, but it wasn't as vocal, and it doesn't seem to be as vociferous or outspoken as it was in the House committee. I'd be curious to know if Representative Corlew is confident that he can get that bill moving, because obviously there's a lot of people with privacy concerns that are not so inclined to turn over their documents and have them scanned and stored by the state. I know his bill has creates that bifurcated method where you can opt in or opt out, but it doesn't seem to be winning a lot of accolades from some segments of his own party.
I appreciate that question, Jason. And it's we need to fix our Real ID situation. In 2005, the Congress implemented the Real ID Act to enhance security in terms of state identifications, and through the procedures and mechanisms that a state identification is issued by. In 2009, our state legislature put in a law that said we would not comply. So, and as of last year in 2016. It has affected Missourians when they try to go on military bases. They have to have additional identification besides their Missouri license. In our hearing this week, we heard from family members who had been turned away at military bases or military institutions. We heard from truck drivers who are having a hard time delivering goods onto the bases. We heard from our airport facilities that are concerned at what might happen next year. We heard from travel agencies and people that travel for business. So this impacts a wide swath of Missourians, and we need to take care of it. I recognize that there are some concerns in privacy and also just a pushback on the federal government. And we're trying to address those. In particular, the legislation that I have in the House, and also that Senator Sylvie and others have in the Senate, is have an option for citizens, that they can choose to have the Real ID compliant license, or they can choose not to and have the regular Missouri license that we have now.
Back to Jason's question, I mean, what do you think are the chances of your fellow Republicans moving this forward?
I think we will get this done. I'm confident that we will. I knew all along that we were going to have the debate, and we should. We should have good, healthy, robust debates in the House of Representatives, and they're going to be along those two issues. I think that we can answer and address those concerns, I believe that we have a majority of our party that have heard from their citizens, just like I have over and over, that are asking us, why aren't you getting this fixed? And I think at the end of the day, we'll come together along with our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. We'll have a bipartisan effort and be able to pass this and do something good for our citizens, a very practical step that makes a difference for them.
Well, all that to say, this all amounts to a pretty interesting first month of new legislative session. As it continues, we'll keep talking about it. Jason Hancock covers the State House for the Kansas City Star. Jason, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Representative Kevin Corlew, Republican from Kansas City's Northland, thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate it, Brian. Thank you for the opportunity.
As you know, since this is your second time with us, we ask our legislator guests to capture the moment by choosing our closing music. What do you suggest today?
Well, I'm a big fan of the band Switchfoot, and there's a song that over the past few years that I've really enjoyed. It's called Dark Horses.
Outstanding. Kevin Corlew, thanks again.
Thank you.
State House Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you on the radio.
You can find full episodes of State House Blend Missouri wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to State House Blend Kansas as well. Tomorrow on the show, a conversation at the square about the factors outside of schools that can affect students' performance inside the classroom. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.